Topic 41. Test to Code. The first edition of this book was written in more primitive times, when most developers wrote no tests. Why bother, they thought. The world was going to end in the year 2000 anyway. In that book, we had a section on how to build code that was easy to test. It was a sneaky way of convincing developers to actually write tests. These are more enlightened times. If there are any developers still not writing tests, they at least know that they should be. But there's still a problem. When we ask developers why they write tests, they look at us as if we just asked them if they still coded using punch cards, and they'd say, "to make sure the code works," with an unspoken "you dummy" at the end. And we think that's wrong. So, what do we think is important about testing? And how do we think you should go about it? Let's start with the bold statement. Tip 66. Testing is not about finding bugs. We believe that the major benefits of testing happen when you think about and write the tests, not when you run them. Thinking about tests. It's a Monday morning and you settle in to start work on some new code. You have to write something that queries the database to return a list of people who watch more than 10 videos a week on your World's Funniest Dishwashing Videos site. You fire up your editor and start by writing the definition of the function that performs the query. Def return avid viewers. Stop. How do you know that what you're about to do is a good thing? The answer is that you can't know that. No one can. But thinking about tests can make it more likely. Here's how that works. Start by imagining that you'd finished writing the function and now had to test it. How would you do that? Well, you'd want to use some test data, which probably means you want to work in a database you control. Some frameworks can handle that for you, running tests against a test database. But in our case, that means we should be passing the database instance into our function rather than using some global one, as that allows us to change it while testing. So our function changes to def return avid users, open paren db, closed paren. Then we have to think about how we'd populate that test data. The requirement asks for a list of people who watch more than 10 videos a week. So we look at the database schema for fields that might help. We find two likely fields in a table of who watched what, opened video and completed video. To write our test data, we need to know which field to use. But we don't know what the requirement means, and our business contact is out. Let's just cheat and pass in the name of the field, which will allow us to test what we have and potentially change it later. Def return avid users, open paren db, qualifying field name, close paren. We started by thinking about our tests. And without writing a line of code, we've already made two discoveries and used them to change the API of our method. Tests drive coding. In the previous example, thinking about testing made us reduce coupling in our code by passing in a database connection rather than using a global one, and increase flexibility by making the name of the field we test a parameter. Thinking about writing a test for our method made us look at it from the outside, as if we were a client of the code and not its author. Tip 67. A test is the first user of your code. We think that this is probably the biggest benefit offered by testing. Testing is vital feedback that guides your coding. A function or method that is tightly coupled to other code is hard to test, because you have to set up all that environment before you can even run your method. So making your stuff testable also reduces its coupling. And before you can test something, you have to understand it. That sounds silly, but in reality, we've all launched into a piece of code based on a nebulous understanding of what we had to do. We assure ourselves that we'll work it out as we go along. Oh, and we'll add all the code to support the boundary conditions later, too. Oh, and the error handling. And the code ends up 5 times longer than it should be because it's full of conditional logic and special cases. But shine the light of a test on that code and things become clearer. If you think about testing boundary conditions and how that will work before you start coding, you may well find the patterns in the logic that'll simplify the function. If you think about the error conditions you'll need to test, you'll structure your function accordingly. Test-driven development. There's a school of programming that says that, given all the benefits of thinking about tests up front, why not go ahead and write them up front too? They practice something called test-driven development, or TDD. You'll also see this called test-first development. As an aside, some folks argue that test-first and test-driven development are two different things, saying that the intents of the two are different. However, historically, test-first, which comes from extreme programming, or XP, was identical to what people now call TDD. The basic cycle of TDD is 1. Decide on a small piece of functionality you want to add. 2. Write a test that will pass once that functionality is implemented. 3. Run all tests. Verify that the only failure is the one you just wrote. 4. Write the smallest amount of code needed to get the test to pass and verify that the tests now run cleanly. 5. Refactor your code. See if there is a way to improve on what you just wrote, the test or the function. Make sure the tests still pass when you're done. The idea is that this cycle should be very short, a matter of minutes, so that you're constantly writing tests and then getting them to work. We see a major benefit in TDD for people just starting out with testing. If you follow the TDD workflow, you'll guarantee that you always have tests for your code, and that means you'll always be thinking about your tests. However, we've also seen people become slaves to TDD. This manifests itself in a number of ways. They spend inordinate amounts of time ensuring that they always have 100% test coverage. They have lots of redundant tests. For example, before writing a class for the first time, many TDD adherents will first write a failing test that simply references the class's name. It fails, then they write an empty class definition, and it passes. But now you have a test that does absolutely nothing. The next test you write will also reference the class, and so it makes the first unnecessary. There's more stuff to change if the class name changes later, and this is just a trivial example. Their designs tend to start at the bottom and work their way up. We'll talk more about that in a minute. By all means, practice TDD. But if you do, don't forget to stop every now and then and look at the big picture. It's easy to become seduced by the green tests passed message, writing lots of code that doesn't actually get you closer to a solution. TDD. You need to know where you're going. The old joke asks, how do you eat an elephant? The punchline? One bite at a time. And this idea is often touted as a benefit of TDD. When you can't comprehend the whole problem, take small steps, one test at a time. However, this approach can mislead you, encouraging you to focus on and endlessly polish the easy problems while ignoring the real reason you're coding. An interesting example of this happened in 2006, when Ron Jeffries, a leading figure in the agility movement, started a series of blog posts which documented his test-driven coding of a Sudoku solver. After 5 posts, he'd refined the representation of the underlying board, refactoring a number of times until he was happy with the object model, but then he abandoned the project. It's interesting to read the blog posts in order and watch how a clever person can get sidetracked by the minutiae, reinforced by the glow of passing tests. And we'd just like to say thank you to Ron Jeffries for letting us use this story. His willingness to share a failure exemplifies the spirit of agility. As a contrast, Peter Norvig describes an alternative approach at norvig.com, which feels very different in character. Rather than being driven by tests, He starts with a basic understanding of how these kinds of problems are traditionally solved, using constraint propagation, and then focuses on refining his algorithm. He addresses board representation in a dozen lines of code that flow directly from his discussion of notation. Tests can definitely help drive development, but as with every drive, unless you have a destination in mind, you can end up going in circles. Bottom-up versus top-down versus the way you should do it. Back when computing was young and carefree, there were two schools of design, top-down and bottom-up. The top-down folk said you should start with the overall problem you're trying to solve and break it into a small number of pieces. Then break each of these into smaller pieces, and so on, until you end up with pieces small enough to express in code. The bottom-up folks build code like you'd build a house. They start at the bottom, producing a layer of code that gives them some abstractions that are closer to the problem they are trying to solve. Then they add another layer, with higher-level abstractions. They keep on until the final layer is an abstraction that solves the problem. Make it so, as Jean-Luc Picard would say. Neither school actually works, because both ignore one of the most important aspects of software development. We don't know what we're doing when we start. The top-down folks assume they can express the whole requirement up front. They can't. The bottom-up folks assume they can build a list of abstractions which will take them eventually to a single top-level solution. But how can they decide on the functionality of layers when they don't know where they are heading? Tip 68. Build end-to-end, not top-down or bottom-up. We strongly believe that the only way to build software is incrementally. Build small pieces of end-to-end functionality, learning about the problem as you go. Apply this learning as you continue to flesh out the code. Involve the customer at each step and have them guide the process. And now, back to the code. Component-based development has long been a lofty goal of software development. The idea is that generic software components should be available and combined just as easily as common integrated circuits, ICs, are combined. But this works only if the components you are using are known to be reliable, and if you have common voltages, interconnect standards, timing, and so on. Chips are designed to be tested, not just at the factory, not just when they are installed, but also in the field when they are deployed. More complex chips and systems may have a full built-in self-test feature that runs some base-level diagnostics internally, or a test access mechanism that provides a test harness that allows the external environment to provide stimuli and collect responses from the chip. We can do the same thing in software. Like our hardware colleagues, we need to build testability into the software from the very beginning, and test each piece thoroughly before trying to wire them together. Unit testing. Chip-level testing for hardware is roughly equivalent to unit testing in software, testing done on each module, in isolation, to verify its behavior. We can get a better feeling for how a module will react in the big wide world once we have tested it thoroughly under controlled, even contrived, conditions. A software unit test is code that exercises a module. Typically, the unit test will establish some kind of artificial environment, then invoke routines in the module being tested. It then checks the results that are returned, either against known values or against the results from previous runs of the same test, regression testing. Later, when we assemble our software ICs into a complete system, we'll have confidence that the individual parts work as expected, and then we can use the same unit test facilities to test the system as a whole. We talk about this large-scale checking of the system in ruthless and continuous testing. Before we get that far, however, we need to decide what to test at the unit level. Historically, programmers threw a few random bits of data at the code, looked at the print statements, and called it tested. We can do much better. Testing against contract. We like to think of unit testing as testing against contract. We want to write test cases that ensure that a given unit honors its contract. This will tell us two things: whether the code meets the contract and whether the contract means what we think it means. We want to test that the module delivers the functionality it promises over a wide range of test cases and boundary conditions. What does this mean in practice? Let's start with a simple numerical example, a square root routine. Its documented contract is simple. The precondition is that the argument is greater than or equal to 0, and the postcondition is that squaring the result we return gives you a number very close to the original argument. This tells us what to test. Pass in a negative argument and ensure that it is rejected. Pass in an argument of 0 to ensure that it is accepted. This is the boundary value. Pass in values between 0 and the maximum expressible argument and verify that the difference between the square of the result and the original argument is less than some small fraction of the argument. Armed with this contract, and assuming that our routine does its own pre- and post-condition checking, we can write a basic test script to exercise the square root function. This is a pretty simple example. In the real world, any non-trivial module is likely to be dependent on a number of other modules. So, how do we go about testing the combination? Suppose we have a module A that uses a data feed and a linear regression. In order, we should test 1. Data feed's contract in full, 2. Linear regression's contract in full, 3. A's contract, which relies on the other contracts but does not directly expose them. This style of testing requires you to test subcomponents of a module first. Once the subcomponents have been verified, then the module itself can be tested. If data feed and linear regression's tests passed but A's test failed, we can be pretty sure that the problem is in A, or in A's use of one of those subcomponents. This technique is a great way to reduce debugging effort. We can quickly concentrate on the likely source of the problem within module A and not waste time re-examining its subcomponents. Why do we go to all this trouble? Above all, we want to avoid creating a time bomb, something that sits around unnoticed and blows up at an awkward moment later in the project. By emphasizing testing against contract, we can try to avoid as many of those downstream disasters as possible. Tip 69. Design to test. Ad hoc testing. Not to be confused with odd hack, ad hoc testing is when we poke at our code manually. This may be as simple as a console.log, or a piece of code entered interactively in a debugger, IDE environment, or REPL. At the end of the debugging session, you need to formalize this ad hoc test. If the code broke once, it is likely to break again. Don't just throw away the code you created. Add it to the existing unit test arsenal. Build a test window. Even the best sets of tests are unlikely to find all the bugs. There's something about the damp, warm conditions of a production environment that seems to bring them out of the woodwork. This means you'll often need to test a piece of software once it has been deployed, with real-world data flowing through its veins. Unlike a circuit board or chip, we don't have test pins in software, but we can provide various views into the internal state of a module without using the debugger, which may be inconvenient or impossible in a production application. Log files containing trace messages are one such mechanism. Log messages should be in a regular, consistent format. You may want to parse them automatically to deduce processing time or logic paths that the program took. Poorly or inconsistently formatted diagnostics are just so much spew. They are difficult to read and impractical to parse. Another mechanism for getting inside running code is the hotkey sequence or magic URL. When this particular combination of keys is pressed or the URL is accessed, a diagnostic control window pops up with status messages and so on. This isn't something you normally would reveal to end users, but it can be very handy for the help desk. More generally, you could use a feature switch to enable extra diagnostics for a particular user or class of users. A culture of testing. All software you write will be tested. If not by you and your team, then by the eventual users. So you might as well plan on testing it thoroughly. A little forethought can go a long way toward minimizing maintenance costs and help desk calls. You really only have a few choices. Test first, test during, test never. Test first, including test-driven design, is probably your best choice in most circumstances, as it ensures that testing happens. But sometimes that's not as convenient or useful. So test during coding can be a good fallback, where you write some code, fiddle with it, write the tests for it, then move on to the next bit. The worst choice is often called test later, but who are you kidding? Test later really means test never. A culture of testing means all the tests pass all the time. Ignoring a spew of tests that always fail makes it easier to ignore all the tests, and the vicious cycle begins. Treat test code with the same care as any production code. Keep it decoupled, clean, and robust. Don't rely on unreliable things like the absolute position of widgets in a GUI system, or exact timestamps in a server log, or the exact wording of error messages. Testing for these sorts of things will result in fragile tests. Tip 70. Test your software, or your users will. Make no mistake, testing is part of programming. It's not something left to other departments or staff. Testing, design, coding, it's all programming. All right, everybody. Before we go on, Dave has a confession to make.
I've been known to tell people that I no longer write tests. Partly I do it to shake the faith of those who have turned testing into a religion, and partly I say it because it is, well, somewhat true. I've been coding for 45 years and writing automate tests for more than 30 of them. Thinking about testing is built into the way I approach coding. It felt comfortable. Unfortunately, the way my personality works, that once I start to feel comfortable with something, I have to move on to something else. In this case, I decided to stop writing tests for a couple of months and see what it did to my code. To my surprise, the answer was not a lot. So I spent some time working out why. I believe the answer is that, for me, most of the benefit of testing comes from thinking about the tests and their impact on the code. And, after doing it for so long, I could do that thinking without actually writing tests. My code was still testable, it just wasn't tested. But that ignores the fact that tests are also a way of communicating with other developers. So I now do write tests on code shared with others, or that relies on the peculiarities of external dependencies. Andy says I shouldn't include this note. He worries it will tempt inexperienced developers not to test. So here's my compromise. Should you write tests? Yes. But after you've been doing it for, say, 30 years, feel free to experiment a little to see where the benefit lies for you.